this morning's thoughts, this Thursday morning, well into the retreat period. What I decided to give a talk on this morning is on the five khandhas. And to give a talk on this subject, because I've mentioned it so far in the question time as parts of other talks, and also I wanted to show what these five khandhas are and why the Buddha talked about the five khandhas, and how they can be used in the practice of meditation. In particular, how they start to really describe the attachment we call the upadana, and the craving, what causes us to take hold of something as being me or mine. And so I wanted to talk about the five khandhas this morning. Actually, the word khandha just means a group of things. There's any sort of collection of things that you may even say is a khandha of cutlery in the kitchen there, just a group of things. And that's all a khandha means, just a group of things. And when the Buddha wanted to describe a person, you know, this thing in here which we think is us, in order to analyze it, he decided to analyze it in terms of these five khandhas, these five aspects or groups of things which together comprise what we call the human being. And as such, he split up the human being as these five khandhas for one particular reason, that by focusing on these main aspects, so we can actually see the cause of all the trouble. So you might call them the five aspects, we might call them the five troublemakers. And this is identifying them, seeing how they cause the trouble, then we can maybe do something about it. So this talk this morning is about the five troublemakers, which people take to be themselves. In brief, those five troublemakers are the body, this thing we call Vedana, which I did mention earlier on, as that aspect of all sensory experience which is pleasant, unpleasant, or somewhere in between. And this perception, and this mental formations, which includes things like thought and will, and this consciousness itself. And when you add all these things together, they sometimes overlap each other, but certainly they cover everything which is what we take to be a person. So you can't find anything sort of outside of these five khandhas which really relates to you as a body or as a person. So this is an analysis which covers the whole of the body and the mind. But sometimes these things, they do overlap. And what these five troublemakers are is just different aspects of one experience, one conscious experience of now. And one conscious experience of now has an aspect to it which is bodily, one aspect to it which is the Vedana, the pleasure or the pain of it, one aspect of it which is the perception, one aspect of it which is the mental formation part, and of course the background consciousness. In much the same way that if you have a cup, you have its shape, you have its size, you have its weight, you have its color. And these are all aspects of one and the same cup. And so these five khandhas are just aspects of one and the same conscious experience, one moment of being, if you like. So as such, that usually you start looking at each of these five khandhas and trying to understand exactly what they are. The first one is probably the most easy one to understand, the body, you know, which is this frame over here, the skin and the bones and everything else which make up this body. And the Buddha was just saying this is like a khandha, something which comes and goes. It's a group of things which are held together by causes. And once those causes sort of disappear, then the body disappears. It was one interesting reflection which I had to think about some time ago when I was considering an answer to the question that we had last night on abortion or euthanasia. Actually, what actually is death? In the Buddhist definition, what is actually life? And the Buddhist actually definition of this is that life, that which we call life, always needs to have some sort of fuel. It needs to be sustained. And to kill someone is basically just cutting off those nutrients or those things which support life. And if you cut off the support, the cause for maintaining life, then life stops. You always have to be supporting this life. It doesn't actually support itself. You always need some cause to keep it going. You need food for the body. And you need will for the mind to keep it going. If you give up hope or you just decide to die, then in some situations, just that cutting off of the will to live is all that's needed to stop this whole process and for you to die. So when we talk about the life and death, to understand that to keep this body going, to keep this mind going, it needs a cause. It's not self-sustaining. And in those jhana states I was talking about the last few days, especially those states where beings get reborn for many eons, what keeps them alive, their food, is just the bliss of that state. That bliss is what maintains the mind in that state. And that's why sometimes the Buddha said there are devas who feed on bliss, who eat bliss, who drink bliss. And that's all they eat. It's much better than breakfast. So this is what keeps the body going. Once you can actually see that this body just keeps on going because of food and because of exercise and because of air, and then you can see it's like conditionality, it's cause. And when these causes disappear, then the body breaks down. And the contemplation of the body is one of the first of the Satipatthanas. And I wanted to use the Satipatthanas with these five khandhas to show that how we reflect upon these things, to give us a sense of freedom, born of wisdom. The first of the Satipatthanas is reflecting on this body of ours. You see, it's just like a body and nothing more. One of the reflections which we teach a person when they first become a monk, and you may have heard me talk about this in the ordination ceremonies which we have, is to talk about the five external aspects of this first khandha of the body. The hair of the head, the hair of the body, nails, teeth and skin. And the reason why we concentrate on these external aspects of the body is because this is what's readily apparent. Now, you can't really see the bones, you can't really see the blood, and you can't really see all the organs inside. What you can see of a person is their hair and their skin, their nails and their teeth. And one of the very interesting reflections for those of you who are very attached to bodies, either your own or somebody else's, is to notice that all these things which you see in someone else are all dead. Because the hair which you see of a person, the hair which I'm looking at now, is all dead stuff. Because the live roots are actually underneath the skin, you can't see those. And the hair there is dead. You try and cut it, it doesn't hurt. It's dead, there's no nerves in there, it's dead stuff. And the same with the teeth. There's a live part in the root inside, but the teeth itself is dead. And the nails are dead. And even the skin, which you see here, it's all dead stuff on the outside. The live stuff is a few millimetres underneath, or a millimetre or two underneath. But actually the skin which you see there, which is already peeling off and flaking off, because it's dead stuff. And so whenever you see a very handsome man or a very beautiful girl, what you're actually seeing is just a lot of dead stuff. It's all dead matter. And whenever you embrace someone and kiss them passionately, you're just kissing a corpse. All that dead skin coming off. So this is a body. This is a body which we sort of celebrate and put on front covers of magazines. And when you look at it that way, you can just see that what you're looking at is already all dead. Even the most fit and healthy person is just dead. And so this is just a way of looking. And it brings up laughter or brings up shock sometimes, but it's true, isn't it? What we think is alive is hidden deep inside. And the live part, if you actually look at it, I don't know if any of you have ever had the opportunity to go to autopsies. That's one of the things we try and do as monks and nuns. It's very difficult to do it in here in Australia. Some years ago, the previous coroner was is much more amenable, and we did were fortunate to go to see an autopsy or two. But in Asian countries, especially Buddhist countries, it's quite easy to arrange for the monks to go and see an autopsy to contemplate what his body is truly like. And it fascinates me that why sometimes people feel a bit queasy when they have an autopsy. Or when, not when they have an autopsy, because they don't do anything there. When they're looking at an autopsy, I meant to say. Because it's just the body, that's all. And I think if you feel afraid or if you feel queasy and a bit sick, it's only because that's challenging your feelings about your own body, your attachment to your body, the way you look at your body. Because there is somebody's body being opened up and you see what you truly are. Now, the whole idea of a religion like Buddhism is come to the truth of things, to find out things as they really are. So what better way to find out the way things really are than to go to an autopsy and to see a person cut up and see what you are as well. And see your bones and see your blood and see your liver and all these other little things which make up you. And it's not that big inside. It's very, very small. And to see your brain as well. Tiny. And this is what makes you up. And this is something we become so attached to and so we find so dear to us, this body of ours. And so as we contemplate this first candor of the body, the Buddha said to look at it very carefully and to see what it truly is, to see how it's supported by all this food, how it came from your mother and father. Ajahn Chah used to say that. He said, where did you come from? Where were you born? And he said, I was born from my mother's womb. That's where he was from. And to remember that, where you're from. And you just eat food, and this keeps this body going. And there'll come a time when it wears out and where it dies. And once you keep contemplating the body like that, after a while, you get quite detached from the body. You realize it's just like a vehicle. It's just like a car. And I mention this very often in Nolamara. You don't own this vehicle. It's just rented. That's all. And when the owner wants it back, don't just call for it back. Even if you're not ready, you have to give it up. The owner of this body is nature. And nature wants this body back. It says, give it me back. You say, can I have another 5 minutes? I've got something to do. Say, no, no, not even 1 minute, not even 1 second. When it wants it back, it takes it back. That's the nature of this body. And so when we look upon this body, this first of these candors, if it ever gives us any fear, it shows that there's some sort of attachment there. And that type of attachment which we have towards this body, thinking it mine or thinking it us, is always going to give us lots of suffering. If you have a very fit body and you're a great sort of sportsman or athlete, there always comes a time when you have to lose, when the body gets weak and someone gets stronger than you. If you have a very beautiful body, there comes a time when it starts to get ugly. And you have to spend lots of money trying to keep it looking beautiful. And it's a lot of pain. If you have a very agile body, after a while it just starts to ache and be hard to sit cross-legged or whatever. If you're proud of how long you can sit, or if you can sit straight, or anything else to do with the body, it's just being attached to this body, that's all. It doesn't matter when you're sitting meditation how long you sit, as long as it's quality meditation. Ajahn Chah used to say that. Because some of the monks were almost having competitions who could sit longest. I can sit for 2 hours now, that's nothing, I can sit for three. And to stop all of that, Ajahn Chah just said, look, you monks, said, if it really mattered how long you sat, then all the chickens in the world would be enlightened. Because they can sit still for hours and hours and hours on end. But I've never met an enlightened chicken, because it's not how long you sit, it's the quality of what you're doing when you're sitting. So don't worry about in this retreat whether it's only half an hour or whether it's 2 hours, as long as it's really mindful, very good quality meditation, that's what's important. So the Buddha taught about the Rupa Khanda, that's the body, because there's a lot of attachment there with human beings. And even sometimes monks, you see, I'm not attached to my body, I know it's just, it rises and passes away and it's going to die one day. but then they have to go to the dentist, or they have to go to the doctor, or they start to get sick, or they start to die. And that's when you can really see whether there's any attachment there, when it's about to be taken away from you. And this is where contemplation now, looking at this body, looking at this body as a nature to get old and to die, you can't do anything about it. Just be very peaceful. When you are alive and healthy, to use the time as wisely as you can, when it's the time to let this body go, to let it go gracefully. And that's how we look at this body. And then we don't suffer so much. Again, I've been with some people who have been dying, and some of you have done this as well. There's some people who really struggle to live, to live, to live, no matter what. And some people can let go and die very beautifully. Certainly I know which one I'd like to be. Which one would you like to be? The struggler or the person who can die peacefully? How do you do that? You do that by preparing to die now, when you're young and healthy. Preparing to die by just looking at this body and expecting that one day it will die. Loosening your attachment to it, loosening your reliance on it. And keep on regarding it. This is not mine. This is not mine. This is not mine. It's just something I rent, just something I use. While I'm renting it, while I'm using it, let's use it wisely. So when the time comes that I have to give it in, I can always know that I've used this wisely, as best I could, with the time I had. That's how one should look at this body. But of course, people know that this body is not just the end of themselves. There's much more to the body than there's much more to themselves than the body. And this is the thing they call the mind. And when we start looking at the mind, the first part of the mind the Buddha wanted people to focus on is this thing which they call Vedana. It is, as I said earlier, that aspect of every sensory experience, even this one you're experiencing right now, which is pleasurable, which is painful, or somewhere in between. In the same way that a cup has colour or a carpet has colour, in the same way every experience of the senses will always have this colour to it. If it's the experience of sight, it will be beautiful, ugly, or somewhere in between. If it's sound, it will be sonorous or discordant or somewhere in between. If it's smell, it will be fragrant, it will be terrible smell, it will be somewhere in between. If it's taste, it will be delicious, it will be really awful to taste, it will be somewhere in between. If it's the feeling in the body, it will be pain or be pleasure or somewhere in between. If it's a mental object, it will be happiness, it will be the inner suffering or somewhere in between. And each sensory experience has that flavor to it. And because it has that flavor, and people don't understand it, whenever there's anything on the side of pleasure, on the side of beauty, fragrance, sonorous, anything on that side, the people tend to attach to it. I like this, I want to keep it, I want more. And anything which is on the side of pain, ugliness, bad smell or whatever, people tend to have aversion. I want to get rid of this. I can't stand this. It shouldn't be like this. Because that's the usual reaction of people, that people, all new people in this world, just go from attaching to suffering, from suffering and then attaching to something else, always having this pain in the world, because they're pulled and pushed by like and dislike. And here the Buddha was pointing out the cause of that like and dislike, and showing that because this is inherent in every sensory experience, that we can look at this sensory experience and see that you can't just have one side of Vedana, you can't just have the pleasurable side. It would be wonderful, wouldn't it, if we only had pleasurable sights and pleasurable sounds and only the food we like and nice smells and no one ever passed wind in the meditation hall and that we never had any pain in the body and that we only had nice mind states. But what's the reality of it? the reality, especially in those world of the five senses, that any pleasure experience in the world of the five senses is always surrounded by pain. The pain which went before and the pain which comes afterwards. Because that's all pleasure is, but a space, a gap between two unpleasant moments. As I was pointing out a couple of days ago, the reason why people are happy when they pass their exams is because of all the pain that went before. The reason why somebody is just jubilant that they win the lotto is because of all those people who didn't win. Imagine if everyone won the lotto. Everyone who bought a ticket won a lotto. It wouldn't be any fun anymore, would it? The reason why the football team just goes berserk when they win a cup, they win the championship, is because all the teams are lost. That's where their happiness comes from. You can see that happiness is always measured by some degree of pain. When you really strive for something, strive really hard, and you finally achieve it, much of that happiness is just because of the pain which went before. It's interesting to see that, because what it means is that a person who thinks they can get sustained happiness, sustained beauty, sustained beautiful sounds in this world, know that that's impossible. I know there are some people who are gourmets, who go off to these really nice restaurants in France or in Europe, only 5-star, nothing less. And there's only a few of them around, apparently. And once they taste that food, it's an amazing, delicious food, and just ordinary cooking is just painful. For someone who's dined in a 5-star restaurant and they have to go tomorrow to the 4-star restaurant, that's suffering. So when you reach the very heights of pleasure, there's always the pain which comes afterwards. And that's why sort of in some of the theistic religions, when they think that sort of the end of life is some heaven realm somewhere, they always contemplate that it's impossible that heaven realm can be all happiness. Because you can't have happiness without suffering. As I said before, that if you go to the traditional Christian heaven realm, you're supposed to have ambrosia to eat. Imagine ambrosia for breakfast, lunch and dinner. After a few centuries, you'd be sick to the teeth of ambrosia. Anything but ambrosia, please. And that's only beautiful harp music. It's very nice when you first get up there, this harp music, but after a while it sort of really gets up your nose. Isn't it the case that no matter how happy it is, after a while it gets normal, usual. You just don't notice it anymore. But you can't have happiness without pain. You can't have pain without happiness. These two are the dualism of vedana, of sensation. And that's why the efforts of human beings in this world to try and overcome all pain, all things which are unpleasant, and only have the pleasant around you, is futile. It's impossible. It cannot be done. No matter how powerful, wealthy, skilled you are, we all have to endure sort of pain together with pleasure. Once we understand this, that the two go together and are inseparable, then what does that do? What it does is that whenever we get pain, we realize that was because of the pleasure we just had. Whenever we get pleasure, that's just because of the pain. They're inseparable, so we don't start complaining and we don't think that something's gone wrong when the pleasure disappears and we have unpleasant situations or experiences. We don't blame anybody. We don't feel guilty, or we don't have lack of self-worth or whatever. We realize this is natural to do this. This is the world. And when things get really lovely and pleasurable and things are going well, we don't think, oh, at last I've got it right. Now it's going to be like this forever. Just like when you get married. I'm going to be happy forever and ever. And of course, it doesn't work. You always have the pain and the difficulty together with the pleasure. They go together. And also it means whenever there's any despair, because there's a lot of pain in the body, a lot of disappointment in life, You don't need to despair because you know there must be some pleasure around somewhere. You can't have pain and disappointment just alone. There'll always be some pleasure there somewhere. Even in the concentration camps in Germany, people still told jokes. They still laughed from time to time. Even the worst places, there's always some pleasure. There's never places of just pain and no other pain. Even down in hell, I'm sure the devil tells jokes. And it makes the pain even worse. It's a joke like mine, anyway. Anyway, this is the pleasure, the pleasure and pain of life. They go together. And so, once you realize they're inseparable, then you accept them both. And you don't have all this craving, the stupid craving, the craving which can never get you anywhere, of just having happiness and never having pain. And when it's pain, you know, it's not going to last. No matter how painful it gets, always remember that, this cannot last. This cannot last. It'll either get better or get worse. It won't last the same. And then it sort of changes. That's the nature of these things. So seeing the changeable nature of sensations, by focusing on them, it means they're not mine in the sense that we don't control them, they're part of nature, they'll change by themselves according to their causes, and we get a sense of serenity towards them, a sense of dispassion towards even the pains in our body, and also dispassion towards the pleasures of life as well. Sometimes this is one of the mistakes of Buddhists. They want to detach from the pain, but they want to hold on to the pleasure. And it doesn't work that way. You've got to detach from both. That's Vedana, that's the second kanda. And again, it's part of every sensory experience. It needs to be noticed. And the main insight is to notice that the two are inseparable, part of duality. You can't have one with the other, without the other. No more than you can have day without night. So seeing that, you can contemplate the next kanda, which is perception, which again is this amazing sort of aspect of reality to focus your attention on. And in this retreat, some of you have been seeing just how weird perception can be, and just how this whole thing of perception works. And this is one of my favorite kandas, because they were great fun playing around with this and seeing if you can actually not so much alter perceptions, but just choose different perceptions which are available to you from time to time. Remember the simile which I gave about perception. It's as if all the sensory experiences are lined up on the supermarket shelf. You can only choose one. And that perception which you choose is what manifests in the mind and becomes your experience. So you have all the possible perceptions. When you look at a person, you can even have that perception, I like them, or I hate them. Both are available to you on the shelf. But you only choose one of those. You can choose to see their good qualities or to pick out their faults. It's the fault-finding mind I was talking about, which just can look at the faults of yourself or other people. Even though the good qualities are on the shelf as well, sometimes we just complain. You can look at the Prime Minister of Australia and straight away think of him as a really awful fellow, just so conceited and just so hopeless, doesn't care about the environment, doesn't care about the indigenous people, doesn't care about this. And you can focus on those qualities, or you can focus on other qualities of the man. How often is it that what we choose as perception is just what's fashionable? Just what other people choose. So we just become one of the crowd. And that's why here I'm encouraging people to be rebellious. What the world sort of dispraises, see if you'll find any perception in that person or thing which is wonderful and praiseworthy. Somebody told me there was they went to work with one fellow who was like that, who would never see any bad in anybody. He trained his perception so well, he'd always see the good in somebody. And so one of his workmates challenged him. He said, look, you never complain about anyone. You never find fault with anyone. What about Adolf Hitler? And this man is very smart. He just thought for one moment. He said, well, At least he was a leader in his field. See, that's how you can use perception. You can always find something good on the supermarket shelf, no matter what's happening there. And this is the same with any other experience you have. You may have sort of a terrible experience you're going through. It might be a divorce, it might be your finances are in ruin, it might be a cancer, it might be some other disease. There's all sorts of perceptions on the shelf there. There's a whole load of negative perceptions you can choose there. This is awful, why me? No, I don't really like this at all. It shouldn't happen. What have I done wrong? No, I was exercising, I was eating brown rice, I was meditating. Why did it happen to me? And you have all those negative perceptions. Or instead you can say, thank you. What a marvelous experience it is. Because now I know I'm going to die. I know roughly when. For so many people, they don't have that gift. They're just happily just walking along the street one day, and they've got all this business to do, and they suddenly just drop dead. They don't have that privilege of knowing they've only got a few months or whatever. It's a marvelous privilege to have that. Because what that does, it really reinforces to you that I am going to die. I am going to die. The doctor tells me. My friends tell me. And so it puts your life in perspective. And in those last few months, you really do so much more work on what counts than what you do in the rest of your life sometimes. So sometimes if something like that happens, you can say it's a privilege. Thank you. That perception is on the shelf there, if you care to take it. And which perception would you, in this the coolness of this retreat, which perception would you hope you take when something like that happens to you? Or the negative perceptions, or the ones which are much more useful? So all the perceptions are there. So why is it we take one particular perception and not another? It's conditioning, it's habit. It comes from the conditioning of what we call defilements. If we're under the defilement of lust or greed, we actually choose the perceptions which reinforce those defilements. If we're going out one evening looking for a partner, we just see some man or woman, then they're not really all that pretty or beautiful, but because we want somebody, we make them to be beautiful. Perception changes what we're actually seeing. If we're really angry and upset, then this under the power of hatred, then whatever we see with the negative perceptions. And some of the people have told me here, sometimes they got so frustrated looking for the nimitta that they got so angry that it's their cushion's fault. Your cushion is just too hard. And they actually hate their cushion. And the cushion's done nothing wrong. It's not the cushion's fault. Come on, be fair. But that perception can come up. Because when you're angry, you can't see anything good in anything. And you know, so the perceptions which sometimes, I'm sure each one of you have had to me, you're just really having a nice meditation and he rings the bell again. He did it on purpose, didn't he? He's got to say he knew I was getting in a good meditation. Or when you're having a terrible meditation and it's going really, really hard, then you say it's much more than sort of past the hour. 5 minutes past, 10 minutes past. Why does he ring the bell? He's doing this on purpose again. So it's those perceptions. I'm not doing it on purpose. I'm just ringing the bell according to my clock, that's all. But what perceptions can do, it can get hate, can see the bad, it can see the faults in a person. Sometimes we're not even there. For those of you who are married, especially those of you who've been married and been divorced already, why did you get married in the first place? And why did you get divorced with that person? You know, really, they haven't changed all that much. It's your perceptions have changed about that person, that's all. When you first saw them, your perceptions were just based on lust and greed. You could only see just the wonderful things in them. When you got divorced, they were based on sheer hatred. And you could only see the rotten things in them. This is sometimes what happens when you have perceptions and if you believe in them. So here we look at the whole process of perception to challenge it and to see, as part of the practice of a deep meditator, to see if we can see the beautiful in the ugly. To see if we can see the ugly in the beautiful. So in the pain in the body, or the sort of the hunger, or the sometimes the despair because you can't get deep meditation, to see if you can perceive the beautiful in that, the pleasurable, the wonderful. And when you have very good things happen to you, to see if you can perceive the ugliness in that. What that does means that you never get aversion or hatred to what irritates you. You never get attached to those things which are pleasurable. You can just play with perception and check yourselves. And it's not that hard to do. The next time you have some very beautiful food, maybe lunchtime, the food which you really, really like, see if you can change the perception of that food as being something really awful. And you won't eat so much. For example, you can imagine, this is what the monks sometimes do, imagine that food which you have on the plate, inside of that, somewhere you can't see it, is what comes out the other end when you finish with that food. Because, you know, the feces have to come from somewhere. They're in there, what you put in the mouth. What goes in must come out. So if you look at the food that way, you know that somewhere inside it, this food here is my feces. It's just like covered over, like, you know, with like paint. You just don't want to eat. Okay, and so other times you have you have food you don't like, you know, food you really hate, and I just can't eat this stuff, it's bad for me. See if you can change the perception around it. This is very, very wonderful. Just start thinking of where all that came from. How many people lovingly put that together? You know, from the time that those things were put as seed in the ground and harvested. And all the people who took them together and cooked it, and the people in the kitchen here who sort of tried to, you know, to bake it or to fry it or whatever else they did to it, make this beautiful food, and they put it on your plate, and it's presented so beautifully, so wonderful. You take those perceptions on board, and then even the food you don't like becomes so delicious. There's been a few times in my monastic life that somebody, a very poor person, has come to give some food. I remember this one person who, this is in our monastery in Thailand, used to come every moon day to bring some food to the monks. But, you know, I didn't really like the food. It was only like some cheap sweets. And it's sort of bad for your health, bad for your teeth, bad for everything. So I usually passed them by. I never used to take any. And then after a while I started to notice that he would always come on his bicycle. And I asked someone where he came from. And he would cycle something like 20, 25 kilometers to get to the monastery every morning. And he just couldn't afford the bus fare. He was just really, really poor. And he came there every week to give what he could afford, which was just some, you know, silly sweets, to the monks. And then he would have to bicycle back again afterwards. When I saw just how hard it was for him to actually give this, from that time on, I always took one of his sweets and ate it. It tasted delicious. Not because it was sweet or because what was inside of it. It tasted delicious because I knew where it came from. Just how hard it was for that person to give that. And that's like changing perception around. There was a food I didn't like, but I like where it came from. And this is how you can play around with perception. It makes it really lovely and very, very beautiful. And we also have those perceptions which build up our understanding of the world. And those are the perceptions which the Buddha said especially to really be careful of. Because, for example, we're having this retreat in a Catholic monastery. And for years, I couldn't understand why anyone could believe in that sort of stuff. You know, why there can be sort of Christianity or Islam or any of these other religions. And it was one of those big questions. It took me a long time to understand. How can there be so many different beliefs in the world? And people be so sure that they're right? We started to understand about perception. If we want to believe in something, we will only choose those perceptions which fit in with our beliefs. And any other perceptions which are available to us, we simply will not see them. We'll be blind to them. In the same way that, say, in the world there, when you have a relationship with another person, when you really want that relationship to continue, but it's going wrong, you just cannot see all of the signs that the relationship is breaking up. It comes as a shock to a person. You know, the husband says to the wife, or the wife says to the husband, "What are you leaving me for?" And the other partner says, "I've been telling you for months." "No, you haven't." "Yes, you have." She has been telling him, but his perceptions have not received all those messages. He's literally blanked them out, because "I don't want to see that." So much of the evidence in the world, if it doesn't fit in with our perceptions, we just do not accept it. That's why I often say, if aliens really did land on Earth, if they landed in Hay Street Mall, sort of on a shopping Sunday afternoon, they would have the hardest time in the world convincing anyone they were real aliens. Everyone would be absolutely convinced it was some sort of merchandising promotion. Why? Because it just doesn't fit into people's scheme of things to have real aliens. It's okay to have aliens in sort of the movies, but not in real life. You just would not see them. Perception would only choose those sorts of ideas which make life comfortable for you. The same way when people die, very few people actually choose the perception of death. They just don't want to face it. And they just keep on thinking they're going to live forever and ever and ever and ever. Even though that perception is on the shelf at any moment, very few people pick it up. That's why when somebody dies, it's a shock. "What do you mean it's a shock? Don't you know I've been born? I must die." People are dying all the time. And even today, I just don't know how many people have died in Perth. It's probably a dozen or more. So why is it that people don't realize that they're going to die? Because they don't choose that perception. It doesn't fit in with what they want to believe in life. And when we get to the different religious beliefs or philosophical beliefs in life, if a person really believes in something, all the perceptions will be bent accordingly. And that's why that whenever you have, or a person has a jhana experience, they come out afterwards, how do they explain that to themselves? According to their perceptions, bent by their beliefs. Which is why a Christian saint is somebody who's experienced one of those jhanas, and they come back afterwards. That experience, how do they perceive that? They already believe in God. That was really, really powerful, and they weren't there. 1 + 1 = 3. They've just experienced God. And you can't convince them otherwise. In the same way that I was really fascinated with a book about out-of-the-body experiences. I think it was the one done by Moody, Life After Life, I think. Is that the book? Yeah, I think it was Raymond Moody. In this particular book, if I'm correct with the right book, that he was in a big teaching hospital in America somewhere, and he was interviewing lots of people about their out-of-the-body experiences. What he was actually doing was, any person who actually died on the operating table or came into the hospital who was clinically dead, who got revived, he gave them a questionnaire. Now, some refused to answer it, but many did. And many had these out-of-body experiences. And it was just a very general theme of what happens. Now, floating outside your body, being able to see and hear what's going on, being a bit surprised that's you down there, and then floating off towards the light, sort of merging into that light, coming out the other side, and meeting somebody there, and then being told that this is not your time and coming back again. It's just a classic out-of-body experience. Some people had all of those, some only part of those experiences. But what fascinated me was the person they met on the other side. And it really depended upon what religion you were. Because this was like a hospital in the US where the people of many different religions and faiths. And what was fascinating, that all the Catholics who went up there, they saw the Virgin Mary. All the Protestants saw Jesus Christ. The Jews saw Moses. The Hindus saw Lord Krishna. And the atheists this is what happens with perception. And so, this is actually where you get all the different religions in the world, the different ideas, and everyone thinks they're right because of the limit of perception. We only choose a part of what we want to see, and that's all. I'm sure that many of you might be thinking of the Buddhist simile of the elephant and the, was it 6 or 7 blind men? I used to tell that a lot until somebody asked me, said, please, whenever I go to Nolamara, just every other talk, we talk about this elephant. I haven't talked about it for years. There's the old story of these blind men. There's an argument in the kingdom between all the government ministers. The king wanted to teach them a lesson. He arranged a festival. At the end of that festival, they led an elephant into the ring. And the king, by hand, took all these blind men and put one blind man's hand on the tusk of the elephant, another blind man's hand on the trunk, one on the head, one on the ears, one on the body, one on the legs, and the last blind man put his hand on the tail of the elephant and asked the blind men, what is an elephant? They'd never seen an elephant before, but now they were feeling it. And of course, depending on where they were feeling, so they described an elephant. The one who felt the tusks says an elephant is like a plowshare if you use to dig the ground. The one who felt the trunk said, don't be stupid, you fool. It can't be that. I'm feeling an elephant. An elephant is like a big snake, like a python. The one who felt the ears and said, a python? No, where will you come from, you idiot? It can't be a python. This is flat. This is like a fan. An elephant is the name of this huge fan which people use to keep themselves cool. And each of those blind men were completely sure that what they felt was true. And they had an argument. And he said, this is what happens with perception. It's not that we're limited with what we experience, but also with what we actually feel. We add more to it than what's really there. And that's why in Buddhism we don't even trust perception. And part of the training in this meditation retreat is to show how weird perception can be. How one moment, you know, you'd be sitting here, and your body feels ordinary. In the next moment it can be all light. It can be huge or it can be small. It can go way over there. Perception is strange. But why is it we always believe in our perception? And why is it we fight over our perception? I'm right. My perception is right and your perception is wrong. Why is it that we get trapped in perceptions? Likes and dislikes. So when we see that the way that perception works, this third canon, becomes fascinating. And it relieves us of so much suffering and gives us more understanding of the world. This is just perception, that's all. So don't trust it. Even what you see in front of your very eyes, don't trust it. You could be adding much more on there than is truly there. The reality, this is a seminar I've been giving quite often, the reality is it's like one of those children's colouring books. There's black lines on white paper. That's what life is. And we put all these colours on it. If we can somehow just take those colours off, then this will just be the process. That's all just life. It's us who've created all these colours, which causes all the illusion. That's perception. The next of the canons, I better be going on quickly here, is the mental formations. And these, again, are just things which people believe in as true and real. Just, you know, when we have sort of put this up here, you say cup. That's the mental formation. The name, the start, the thoughts, you know, the will, once I have this up here, you know, as a reaction, sometimes the likes and dislikes, yuck, throw it away. Those likes and dislikes which come as like thoughts in the mind, the names which come in the mind, the will which comes as a reaction to what we experience, that's all part of the mental formations. And especially like the naming and the thoughts which come from that. So I've been trying to point out to you in this retreat, know that even these names which you have, which describe the world, are quite arbitrary. You know, if it's so easy, we can say sort of Australian or Singaporean or Sri Lankan and have a war because of that name. But, you know, you can't believe in those names and labels. They're just approximations. And they miss out so much when you sort of make a distinction between a person, a man or woman. You're only focusing on a small part and you're ignoring just about 99% of what you're seeing. All that's in common is being ignored as you focus on the differences. A lot of naming is doing that, it's just focusing on the small part which is different. These are like mental formations, and we believe in all of that, so much so that even on a meditation retreat where we're not supposed to be thinking at all, how many minutes, how many hours have you wasted thinking about all sorts of different things? And why do you think like that? It's because you value those thoughts. You think they're important. And you even believe them. The Buddha once said, and this is a favorite saying, whatever you think it will be, it's always different. Whatever you think it will be, it's always different. I really took that on board. So it's a waste of time thinking. Whatever you think it is, it's always different to what you think it is. So after a time, you just stop this thinking. It's a complete waste of time. If you saw it as a waste of time, you wouldn't think anymore. However, when you really have the idea it's valuable and you're going to get somewhere with this thinking, then you go on and on and on and on, wasting your time. Somebody gave me a book by an Oxford professor a few months ago called The History of Truth. And it was just like summarizing just the various disciplines, religious, scientific and philosophical, as they sought for the truth. And the latest phase of philosophy is the deconstructionists. And what they've actually basically been proving is this, you know, there is no such thing as truth. You can't find it. It's beyond you. So after all the thousands of years of Western philosophy, they finally discovered they've been wasting their time. That's what's actually come out after all those years. And what a waste of so many people's intellects and times and government's money funding philosophers. They've really deconstructed themselves, not just language. And you can see that thought doesn't get you anywhere. So when you see that those mental formations are just like phantasms which arise, the Buddha called them like onions. He actually called it like a plantain tree. You're trying to find the heart. Is there really some substance in this? But it's all just leaves, just covering nothing. There's no real pith there. Not like a tree. When you take the bark off a tree, there's actually some solid core there. But with a plantain tree, it's just all leaves. Like an onion, as Venerable Gunaratana so brilliantly described it. An onion, you can take all the leaves off and try to get to the heart of the onion, but it's all leaves all the way down. And it's covering nothing. It's got no substance to it. And the brilliance of Venerable Gunaratana was to say the onion, it goes on and on with an eye in the middle. It was quite brilliant there. On and on with an eye in the middle. That's his mental formations. So when you see them substanceless, then you can let them go. You don't believe in your thoughts. It's just a thought, that's all. But you don't give it any importance, which means you're silent much more than you're thinking. And if you write anything down, it's never quite accurate, is it? It's never what was said. only what you think which was said. So you just have a blank sheet of paper in front of you and a blank mind, empty, free. And the last of the five canvases is consciousness itself. And that's a very wonderful one to start looking at. What is this actual consciousness? It's hard to find because consciousness is actually what sees. And as soon as you objectify it, instead of becoming what sees, it becomes what is seen. And consciousness is the hardest of the five khandhas to really get a grip on. And it's one of the reasons why I always say that you can only really understand consciousness in jhanas through that experience. So what actually happens with consciousness is there are six different types of consciousness. There's sight consciousness, there's sight consciousness, smell consciousness, taste consciousness, body consciousness and mind consciousness. But what happens in ordinary life is you have sight consciousness, you see something, and straight away the mind takes hold of it and the mind sees it. You have body conscious, and straight away the mind takes hold of it and the mind understands it. You have smell or taste consciousness, and then the mind comes up right afterwards. So the sequence of the flow of consciousnesses is something like this. Sight, mind, sight, mind, sight, mind. Body, mind, body, mind, body, mind. Taste, mind, body, mind, body, mind. Sight, mind, sight, mind, sight, mind. Sound, mind, sound, mind, sound, mind. Each one of these is discrete moments of consciousness. But because mind consciousness always follows immediately afterwards, it seems that all consciousnesses are the same. Sight plus mind is very similar to sound plus mind, very similar to feeling plus mind. Because this mind consciousness is holding hands, as it were, with all the other consciousnesses, it gives the illusion of the continuity of consciousness. As if that this consciousness flows rather than it just pop, 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 it's individual moments. And what happens when you get into jhanas, all those other five consciousnesses disappear and all you're left is pure mind consciousness with nothing else, just pure mind. And then you know what that mind consciousness is truly like, because it's like gold which has been purified from all the other elements. You just got pure gold there. And only then can a chemist really see the properties of pure gold. When gold is mixed with other elements, you can't really ascertain what it's like. So when the mind is purified from all the other senses and you see pure gold, this mind consciousness, and you know its properties, and when you emerge from that state, you can recognize what's happening with consciousness. You can see the mind consciousness coming up after every other consciousness and interpreting it, understanding it. And then actually what you see is my simile of the fruit salad of consciousness. Instead of just seeing a smooth flow, what you're seeing is like a banana coming up, then the banana completely vanishing, followed by a mango, and the mango completely vanishing, followed by another banana, then another mango, and the mango completely vanishing, followed by an apple, and then another mango, then another apple and another mango. And then you see the mango disappearing and coming up with a plum, and then another mango, and a plum and another mango. The mango stands for the mind consciousness. The banana, the apple, the plum, the other consciousnesses like sight and sound and touch. And you see that these things come up and disappear, come up and disappear, one by one. There's nothing in between. There's nothing going across. There's just the arising of conscious moments, that's all. When you can actually see that, it starts to unravel the illusion of a self born out of the apparent continuity of consciousness. Just like the old movies, where they just had frames which changed very, very quickly and gave the illusion of continuity of movement. But you knew there were just frames on the celluloid, one after another, still shots, moving very fast, giving the illusion of movement, of continuity. That's what consciousness is like. Consciousness is just that which knows. It's just a process, that's all, dependent. Once you can see that, then you'll never again think that it's me who's hearing all of this. It's me who's seeing all of this. The idea of a self behind the screen who's watching all of this play of life disappears. Not just there's no doer, but there's no knower, there's just knowing, that's all. So you focus on consciousness. That's the fifth of these khandhas. The knower, that which knows. Once you can see all of that, then you've seen non-self. You understand, what is this thing I call me? What is this thing which I worry about and I'm so concerned about? Once you see it's completely empty of any continuing being, person, self, soul, whatever you wish to call it. It's just perception playing around. It's just thought, just trying to grab hold of the world, but always imperfectly. It's just consciousness arising and passing away. Once you can see that, then there's no real concern for the world anymore. It's just a process, that's all. And all the striving and the clinging and all of the worrying and all the tears just fade away. That means you're enlightened. You've seen the illusion of this five khandhas. There's nothing there. The Buddha called the consciousness a magician's trick, Maya. Just it throws this illusion up to you, but this is me watching it. That's what it is, just a magician, a conjurer. So when we see that, we understand what the Buddha understood, and then you can enjoy life without worrying about it. And then when you die, you're gone. So those are the five khandhas. Hope you enjoyed them, understood them, and are there any questions about them? Yes. Okay, in the four focuses of mindfulness, and there's five khandhas, how do they all fit together? The four focuses of mindfulness, the first one is on the body, which corresponds to the body khandha. The second one is on vedana, which matches perfectly. And usually meditators usually explain that the third satipatthana on the citta is on consciousness, and the fourth satipatthana, which is on the sankharas, is including the mental formations and also consciousness and also perception. So the perception and mental formations are lumped together in that last one. Yeah. The knower. It's consciousness and the knower. That's what actually consciousness is. That's its function, to know. But one of the important things to always keep in mind, you can't have consciousness without being conscious of something. You can't have knowing without knowing something. There's always an object of consciousness. And that's very important to understand, because when you see that there's an object of consciousness, that knowing is a process, you can see consciousness arising and passing away, instead of thinking it's just some background on which things appear. But without the thing appearing, there is no background. And consciousness and what you're conscious of are dependent upon each other. So it's I sometimes also gave the simile of a TV with five channels on it. And those five channels sight channel, sound channel, smell, taste and touch channel. But very often people can see the play of those channels, and they can see a certain amount of impermanence there. Because the channels switch around, and what's actually on the channel changes. Different programs come on. But what becomes really interesting is, first of all, when there's no channels on at all, when it's just a screen. That screen is the mind. And what gets really interesting is when even the screen disappears as well, and there's no television left there at all. And the mind goes. Then you understand about the cessation, that consciousness is just like that. There's no eternal screen, as it were, on which the play of life and experience is visualized. Seeing blackness is, again, just the sight consciousness is still working, because you know there's the sense of blackness there. But sooner or later, just you're not seeing anything at all. You're not hearing. You're not hearing silence. You're not hearing noise. Just you're not hearing. You're not feeling pleasure in the body. You're not feeling pain. There's just no feeling there at all. You're not feeling numbness. The body's disappeared. And this is what's interesting, to see all these different sense consciousnesses disappear and turn off. Just like you switch off a light. Once you see them disappear and they're gone, then you realize they're not essential. Yeah? The perception, yeah, there's perception in the jhana. In all the jhanas, yeah, but the perception is frozen. Perception is frozen. Just one perception which continues. This is I should actually say the second jhana and above. This is one of the interesting things there. The perception is frozen. So you're just perceiving in one way. Because you're only perceiving in one way, you can't sort of make so much sense of it at the time. It's just, in order to understand an object you've never seen before, you've got to look at it this way and that way and upside down, and then you can actually find out what it is. You need sort of different perspectives to understand it. But within a jhana, just as if you've only got one perspective and it's stable there. Which is one of the reasons why you cannot gain knowledge within a jhana. The perception is happening there. You're conscious. You're certainly very mindful. And there is certainly a very wonderful Vedana there, the bliss. There is no thought there. But the object of Pitisukha is your mental object. But afterwards, only afterwards, you have that image, what you've been looking at, and then at last you can actually look backwards and forwards on it. Yeah. Bring up the image through the power of memory, and then you can look backwards and forwards and get some understanding of what it was. So perception is there, but the perception is very much frozen. Does that make sense to you? Yeah? Maybe, yes? Yeah? Yeah. Is that fear of defilement? Actually, yes, it is fear of defilement at that time. The experience of jhana is always fear of defilement. However, the defilements are only knocked out temporarily. And after you come out of a jhana, very often they're knocked out for quite a while afterwards. Which is one of the reasons why sometimes people get into these jhanas and they think they're fully enlightened. They think, wow, at last, this is it. And you've got to be very careful, because those defilements are only knocked out temporarily and they come back again later on, to your greatest disappointment. After all that, you're so close and then they come back again. No. But within the jhanas, yes, they're gone. Some people say they're latent, so they're not really fully destroyed, but they're not visible. Yes, Shema? Does, yeah? If the sense conscious goes, then the knower can't know it's gone. Yeah. Forgets. No. You've always got the function of memory, which is always keeps you in touch with what's gone in the past, which can sort of always give you that contrast, which is why when I was yesterday morning, when I was giving the talk of emptiness, you always can make a lot of progress in meditation by using the perceptions of now the mind is empty of what was there before. Here and now it's empty of my home and my work. When I meditate, it's empty of the past and the future. So you know what's gone. In jhanas, empty of the five senses, then that is a cause for the bliss to arise. So it's a very powerful way of training the mind to not just notice what's there, but notice what's gone. And that gives you a lot of happiness. Because a memory has arisen in the present moment. This present moment now is empty of home. This present moment now is empty of all that went on in the past. It's empty of the future. But that perception there is in the present moment. It's describing the present moment. But it's using the past as a language to describe it. Yes, or in jhanas, yes. Time would be frozen and space would be just completely just in one point. So there'd be no conception of space or time within the jhana. That's why very often people who go into jhana just don't know how long they've been sitting for. And sometimes they have to look at a clock to find out. If they've got one, it can't be that time. I haven't been sitting that long, surely. So there's no... Sorry? Look at the calendar. Yes, Van Winkle, 40 years. Yeah? Well, cosmic consciousness. Well, if it is, it's a completely different being, nothing to do with us. So, if there's cosmic consciousness, you always ask, well, what's it conscious of? This cosmic consciousness business. And even if it's cosmic consciousness, all consciousness must arise and pass away. There's another factor of consciousness is an interesting one. I should have mentioned it. If you're conscious of one thing a long time, except for in the jhanas, it disappears. It is a constant sound in the room. Then after a while, you can't hear it. Consciousness is basically only notices changes. So that's why if it's something constant, if it's cosmic consciousness is constant, it becomes unconscious. I'll let you think about that one. Yeah? Yes, go on. Well, if you have any sort of perception of emptiness, it's nice and peaceful. And sometimes just a thought comes up because you haven't really stilled the mind yet. The mind is still bubbling. So you can have all sorts of thoughts come up. So that's when you do a lot of meditation, especially calming the mind down. It calms it down so much. The thoughts just don't bubble up anymore. The mind is just happy with that stillness. It just will not allow it to be disturbed. It's like a lake which got no ripples on it. It's just so smooth that no ripples can come in. Okay, I think I better call it a day now. Not a day, call it a morning.